doing of good to man, that our souls are immortal, and that all crime will be punished and virtue rewarded either here or hereafter. Franklin and many of America's founders were examples of ethical monotheists. They were the type of people the Torah wants all people to be. 3. Do you believe in the God who gave the Ten Commandments? This question also needs to be asked, even though it is included in the first question. The reason it needs to be asked is if God never revealed his moral will, how would we know what behaviors he demands from us and what acts he judges as wrong? None of these comments are a judgment of individuals. They are a judgment of the statement, I believe in God. There are people who do not believe in the God of the Torah, and for that matter, people who believe in no God, who are fine, upstanding individuals, just as there are people who believe in the God of the Torah who are not decent people. But for reasons made clear throughout this commentary, the best moral hope for mankind is to bring as many people as possible to belief in the God introduced by the Torah, though not necessarily to Judaism or any other religion. While it is usually best to affiliate with a Torah-based religion, one can believe in the God of the Torah and in the Ten Commandments without being a member of a religion. Verse 13, "And the blood on the houses where you are staying shall be a sign for you." The sign is for you, the Israelites, not for God, who does not need signs. The sign functions to assure the Israelites that they will be spared in spite of all the death that will be taking place around them. Verse 13 continued, "When I see the blood, I will pass over you, so that no plague will destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt." The Hebrew word pasakti means, "I will pass over." Obviously, the English name of the holiday, Passover, comes from this word. Essay: The Six Commandments of Remembrance in the Torah. Verse 14. "This day shall be to you one of remembrance." The Torah affirms the central importance of remembering. It may be credited with the invention of collective memory. There are six commandments of remembrance in the Torah. 1. The Sabbath. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Exodus chapter 20, verse 8. 2. The Exodus. "You shall not eat anything leavened with it, so that you may remember the day of your departure from the land of Egypt as long as you live." Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 3. 3. Receiving the law at Sinai. "So that you do not forget the things that you saw with your own eyes, and make them known to your children and your children's children, the day you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb." Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 9 through 10. 4. Amalek. "Remember what Amalek did to you on your journey after you left Egypt, how, undeterred by fear of God, he cut down all the stragglers in your rear." Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 17 through 19. 5. The golden calf and other incidents in which the Israelites angered God. "Remember, never forget, how you provoked the Lord your God to anger in the wilderness." Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 7. 6. God's punishment of Miriam for speaking ill of Moses. "Remember what the Lord your God did to Miriam on the journey after you left Egypt." Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 9. The verse alludes to Miriam and Aaron's negative comments against Moses in Numbers chapter 12, verses 1 through 9. Why is remembering so important? Here are 9 reasons. 1. Remembering endows history with meaning and significance. If we do not remember an event, then as far as we are concerned, it is as if it never occurred. 2. Remembering enables us to learn from history. Though it may be difficult to know exactly what we should learn from any given historical event, some historical lessons are pretty obvious. For example, it is clear from the Exodus story that freedom is the desired human condition and should be fought for. Indeed, one of its great lessons is God wants humans to be free. This was the essential belief underlying the American Revolution. That is why oppressed groups in the West have so often used the Israelites' liberation from Egypt as their model for liberation. In Exodus and Revolution, The Princeton political philosopher Michael Walzer has made the case that the story of the Exodus has inspired more movements of social change than any other story in literature. 3. Remembering leads to wisdom. Without remembering, wisdom is impossible. See comments on Exodus chapter 10, verse 2. Wisdom is learning from our own lives and from the lives of others. Wisdom matters because good cannot be achieved without it. Good intentions without wisdom lead to either nothing or to actual evil. However much evil movements have appealed to the bad side of people's natures, almost every one of them, communism being the most obvious example, also appealed to people's good intentions. 4. Remembering makes the moral progress of civilization possible. We remember where we came from to know what moral progress or regress we have made. The Torah essentially invented both history and progress. Prior to the Torah, virtually every civilization had what is known as a cyclical worldview. The cyclical worldview is well explained in the book The Gifts of the Jews by Thomas Cahill, a widely noted Catholic scholar of religion. Cahill quotes Henri Charles Houek, author of Man and Time. In the cyclical worldview, no event is unique. Nothing is enacted but once. Every event has been enacted, is enacted, and will be enacted perpetually. The same individuals have appeared, appear, and will appear at every turn of the circle. Nothing, therefore, progresses, not scientifically, not culturally, and most important, not morally. The Jews, specifically and only because of the Torah, differed. As Cahill writes, the Jews were the first people to break out of this circle. It may be said with some justice that theirs is the only new idea that human beings had ever had. 5. Remembering links us with those who came before us and reminds us we are part of an ongoing people and or ideal. 6. Remembering ensures that those who have suffered and perished are not forgotten. 7. Remembering ensures that evil is not forgotten and allowed to disappear into the ash heap of history. 8. Remembering is the only way to avoid repeating the mistakes of the past. 9. Remembering, by ensuring that goodness and good people are not forgotten, makes enduring gratitude possible. Without remembrance, there is no way to stay grateful. Verse 14 continued. You shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord throughout the ages. You shall celebrate it as an institution for all time. The obligation to remember the Exodus is a permanent law. It applies to every subsequent generation. This verse is the first of the many laws that will characterize the distinctive Jewish way of life throughout history. Verse 15, 7 days. Once again, 7, the number of the days of creation, is the most important and recurrent number in the Torah. It reaffirms that God created the world, and therefore the world has purpose, meaning, design, moral standards, etc. The 7 days of Passover can be understood as a replica of the 7 days of creation, because the Exodus from Egypt signifies the start of a new world for the Jews, and therefore for humanity, given the influence the Jews and their Bible have had on history. Verse 15 continued, You shall eat unleavened bread. Because we live in a physical world and need physical signs to concretize our values, major concepts in Judaism have accompanying ritual expressions. Thus, the commandment to remember the Exodus is accompanied by the ritual obligation to eat unleavened bread for 7 days. Which still symbolizes for those who observe this holiday, it is better to eat the poor man's bread in freedom than to eat richer food as a slave. This concept is quite relevant to modern times. Many intellectuals in the Western world defended the half-century, 1959 to 2008, dictatorship of Fidel Castro of Cuba by noting, for example, under Castro's rule, the literacy rate in Cuba rose to 100%. However, Cubans were not allowed to read anything forbidden by the communist regime. In the view of Castro's defenders, it is better to be unfree and literate than to be free and illiterate. The Torah's view, however, would seem to be the opposite. It is better to be free and illiterate, just as it is better to eat a poor man's food and be free than to eat a rich man's food as a slave. Furthermore, the very concept of freedom carries with it the possibility of improvement of one's circumstances. The illiterate are free to learn to read. The poor are free to work, retain the fruits of their labors, and improve their lot in life, perhaps even become wealthy, as so many have in the freedom of the Western, Bible-based world. Leavening represents death. Verse 15 continued. On the very first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. Leavening, a process believed to have been invented in Egypt about 500 years before the Exodus, involves the fermentation of dough. Fermentation is a form of decomposition, and therefore represents decay and death. Egypt was known for its obsession with death. The greatest symbols of ancient Egypt are the pyramids, which are tombs. The Torah, in contrast, is rooted in the affirmation of life. As discussed in detail in Leviticus, the Torah regards that which represents death as tameh, a word usually translated imprecisely as unclean or impure. Perhaps it should be translated as death-related. The Torah and later Judaism, therefore, enacted numerous ritual laws to separate that which represents death from that which represents life. Examples include the separation of milk and meat. Milk comes from a living creature and represents life. Meat comes from a carcass and represents death. The separation of sexual intercourse, life, from menstruation, which represents the death of an egg that would be life had it been fertilized. The draining of the blood from an animal before it is eaten. For the life of all flesh is its blood. Leviticus chapter 17, verse 14, see also Genesis chapter 9, verse 4, and the prohibition on Jewish priests from coming into contact with the dead, as they are to be preoccupied only with life. Thus, the avoidance of leaven on Passover may be seen as a symbolic rejection of the Egyptian preoccupation with death. Much Torah law and teaching is a rejection of the values of Egypt, most particularly the emphasis on death and the worship of nature. What does karet, cut off, mean? Verse 15 continued. For whoever eats leavened bread from the first day to the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. The Hebrew term for cut off is karet, one of the most severe punishments in the Torah. The Torah never makes fully clear what karet means, and there are three different ways in which the Talmud explains the term. First, karet may refer to premature death. However, this understanding is problematic. For one thing, it could lead people to think, or at least suspect, the premature death of a Jew was punishment for some grave sin. And on the other hand, many Jews who violated prohibitions entailing karet went on to live long lives. For these reasons, it is difficult to understand karet as meaning premature death. Second, karet may refer to the eventual ending of the sinner's family line. This explanation has similar problems to the first. It can lead people to erroneously suspect a Jew whose family line has ended, such as countless Jews in the Holocaust, was being punished by God, while many Jews who deserved karet nevertheless had many progeny. On the other hand, this explanation may refer to the ending of a family's Jewish line, and in that sense, the punishment of karet has empirical validity. Jews who raise children without Passover and without ritual circumcision, both of which are punished with karet, regarding circumcision, see Genesis chapter 17, verse 14, tend not to have progeny who remain identifying Jews, and who eventually assimilate into the larger population and disappear as Jews. The third Talmudic explanation for the karet punishment is being cut off from life in the world to come. In my view, the literal definition of karet may well be the best. Those who do not observe laws for which the punishment is karet do indeed cut themselves off from God and from their people. One may therefore explain the person who is punished with karet as cut off from his God and his people. Many of the Torah's most severe punishments, like karet, exist to teach the severity of the offense and to deter people from engaging in the particular sin. That karet is a punishment consequence of eating leaven on Passover shows how important the Torah considers refraining from eating leaven on Passover. Jews who believe in the moral and intellectual greatness of the Torah, not to mention its divine origins, will therefore honor this prohibition. Others will regard the prohibition as a quaint ritual or as simply pointless. But for such people, that is true of most of the Torah. Hopefully, one upshot of this commentary is to show people the Torah is so uniquely wise that when it specifies a law to be observed forever, one ought, at the very least, to consider doing so. Verse 16, you shall celebrate a sacred occasion on the first day and a sacred occasion on the seventh day. There are seven holidays designated as holy days in the Torah. The Torah prescribes seven holidays, six annual holidays plus the weekly Sabbath. 1. Rosh Hashanah. In the Torah, the name for this holiday is Yom Teruah, the day of the shofar sound. 2. Yom Kippur, day of atonement. 3. Pesach, Passover. 4. Shavuot, Pentecost. 5. Sukkot, tabernacles. 6. Shmini Atzeret, eighth day of assembly. 7. Shabbat, Sabbath. Regarding the other Torah-ordained holidays, Jews are commanded, with one important exception to be explained, to observe the same laws as the Sabbath on the first day, and the last day, if there is more than one day, of that holiday. Yom Kippur is the one holy day that maintains all the Sabbath prohibitions, along with the additional prohibition against eating. Three of these holidays, Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuot, are known as pilgrimage festivals, because the Jews traveled on foot to worship at the temple in Jerusalem on these days. Verse 16 continued, no work at all shall be done on them. Only what every person is to eat, that alone may be prepared for you. Based on this one verse, Jewish law held that Jews are allowed to cook on the festivals using a pre-existing fire, unlike on the Sabbath. The festival laws differ from the Sabbath only in respect to the preparation of food. Verse 17, you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for on this very day I brought your ranks out of the land of Egypt. You shall observe this day throughout the ages as an institution for all time. Verse 18, in the first month, from the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. Here is the number 7 again. All of these dates are multiples of 7. Verse 19, no leaven shall be found in your houses for 7 days, for whoever eats what is leavened, that person shall be cut off from the community of Israel, whether he is a stranger or a citizen of the country. Verse 20, you shall eat nothing leavened. In all your settlements you shall eat unleavened bread. Verse 21, Moses then summoned all the elders of Israel and said to them, go, pick out lambs for your families and slaughter the Passover offering. Verse 22, take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood that is in the basin, and apply some of the blood that is in the basin to the lintel and to the two doorposts. The hyssop plant has sponge-like branches that absorb liquid, and it was therefore well-suited to soaking up the sacrificial blood spread on the lintels and doorposts of the Israelite homes. Verse 22 continued, none of you shall go outside the door of his house until morning. We are not told in this verse why the Israelites are instructed to stay indoors, but the reason is most likely safety. As the next verse makes clear, it was only in a home with blood on the doorposts where they were assured protection from the plague that would kill all the firstborn of Egypt. Verse 23, for when the Lord goes through to smite the Egyptians, he will see the blood on the lintel and the two doorposts, and the Lord will pass over the door and not let the destroyer enter and smite your home. Verse 24, you shall observe this as an institution for all time, for you and for your descendants. Verse 25, and when you enter the land that the Lord will give you, as he has promised, you shall observe this rite. Educating one's children is a divine law. Verse 26, and when your children ask you, what do you mean by this rite? The education of children is prescribed in the Torah. See also Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 7. And children are encouraged to ask questions. To this day, children raised in traditional and many non-traditional Jewish homes publicly recite the four questions, the Manishtanah at the Passover Seder. It constitutes most children's first act of public speaking, that is, speaking before a group of adults. And it is not done by affirming a religious credo, but by asking questions. This is one of four verses in the Torah dealing with the commandment to educate children about the Exodus. The Talmud associates each verse with a different type of child. A wise child, a bad child, a simple child, and one who does not know how to ask. The question in this verse is associated with the bad child, because he asks, "What do you mean?" instead of "What do we mean?" or "What does it mean?" He is implicitly excluding himself from the community, as if he is above it all. Verse 27, "You shall say, 'It is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, because he passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but saved our houses.'" The people then bowed low in homage. This answer, which focuses on God's power both to destroy and save, is intended to make an impression on the child by instilling fear of God in him. Fear of a good and moral God is the basis of morality and a moral education. As the Bible states, wisdom begins with fear of God. Psalms 111, verse 10, Proverbs chapter 9, verse 10. Children should also have a degree, and I emphasize a degree of fear of parents. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 3. I have asked many young people why they didn't use illicit drugs, and the single most common response has been, "Because my mother would have killed me." Verse 28. "And the Israelites went and did so, just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did." Verse 29. "In the middle of the night, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne, to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the cattle." The Torah spends several verses on the Paschal sacrifice and the commandment to eat unleavened bread, but only one verse on the killing of the firstborn. It is as if the tenth plague is too painful to relate, as the Egyptians too are God's creatures, and many of the firstborn are innocents. The Torah in no way revels in the Egyptians' punishment, any more, for example, than the Americans, who made the decision to drop the atom bomb, reveled in the suffering of the Japanese people. In fact, one of the Torah's 613 laws actually prohibits hating the Egyptians. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 8. If only the Jews' enemies had such a law regarding Jews. Though if they had such a law, the Jews wouldn't be their enemies. Verse 30. "And Pharaoh arose in the night with all his courtiers and all the Egyptians, because there was a loud cry in Egypt, for there was no house where there was not someone dead." Verse 31. "He summoned Moses and Aaron in the night and said, 'Up, depart from among my people, you and the Israelites with you. Go, worship the Lord as you said.'" Verse 32. "Take also your flocks and your herds, as you said, and be gone, and may you bring a blessing upon me also." Pharaoh, a little too late in the game, finally grants the Israelites everything they previously requested. He also asks Moses and Aaron to save him, because now he believes his life might be in danger as well. Verse 33. "The Egyptians urged the people on, impatient to have them leave the country, for they said, 'We shall all be dead.'" Verse 34. "So the people took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading bowls wrapped in their cloaks upon their shoulders." The Torah has already taught that Jews are obligated to eat unleavened bread on Passover. But this commandment is now infused with national symbolic significance. Eating unleavened bread is a reenactment of the time during the Exodus when the Israelites fled Egypt in haste. Verse 35. "The Israelites had done Moses' bidding and borrowed from the Egyptians objects of silver and gold and clothing." Again, what is translated here as borrowed actually means asked. Verse 36. And the Lord had disposed the Egyptians favorably toward the people, and they let them have their request. Thus they stripped the Egyptians. It is hard to believe the Egyptians felt warmly toward the Israelites, whose God did to some of their children what the Egyptian Pharaoh earlier instructed them to do to all the male Israelite babies. On the other hand, that may be precisely why God's intervention was necessary. How many Israelites left Egypt? Verse 37. The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. If 600,000 men left Egypt, the large majority of whom presumably had wives and children, then a minimum of 2 or more likely 3 million people would have left Egypt. The number 600,000 is based on the Hebrew word eleph, which means thousand. This term may have an additional meaning, such as clan or tribal unit. Therefore, 600 eleph may mean 600 clans, or some large tribal grouping, but less than 1,000. As Boyd Severs, professor of Old Testament studies at Northwestern College, Minnesota, wrote, "One may also understand the numbers literally, but differently than is usually translated. Though eleph usually means thousands, the word could also mean a part of a tribe, perhaps best translated clan, that was smaller than the tribe but larger than an extended family." Editor's note, and all these usages are contained elsewhere in the Bible. For example, Gideon protested to the divine messenger who had called him to leadership, saying, "My clan, eleph, is the weakest in the tribe of Manasseh, and I am the youngest in my family." Judges chapter 6, verse 15. In a later event, Saul sought the fugitive David among all the clans, elephs, of Judah. Alfei Yehudah, 1 Samuel chapter 23, verse 23. In other words, the Hebrew Bible later uses eleph to mean something other than thousand. I should note, there are scholars who reject any definition of eleph other than thousand. If eleph always means thousand, that would mean approximately 2 million Israelites left Egypt. 600,000 males plus an equal number of females plus children. But the Torah itself suggests that may not be a literal number. For example, Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 1 states, "When the Lord your God brings you to the land that you are about to enter and possess, and he dislodges many nations before you, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, 7 nations much larger than you." Now, I think the meaning of that verse is each one of the 7 nations is much larger than the Israelites. That would mean at least 14 million people, 7 times 2 million, lived in Canaan. And that is most unlikely. Today, more than 3,000 years later, there aren't 14 million people in the area known as Canaan. Furthermore, in the same chapter in Deuteronomy, Moses says, "It is not because you are the most numerous of peoples that the Lord set his heart on you and chose you. Indeed, you are the smallest of peoples." A nation of some 2 million is not the smallest of people. Nevertheless, the Torah may well intend that we take eleph literally as thousand. I can live with either understanding of the word, because whatever number of Israelites left Egypt and traveled through the desert for 40 years, it was all a miracle. Verse 38. "Moreover, a mixed multitude went up with them, and very much livestock, both flocks and herds." The Israelites left Egypt along with members of several other nations who comprised the lowest classes of Egyptian society. God could have easily instructed the Israelites not to let the mixed multitude of non-Jews join them. But neither God nor Moses raised any objection to rescuing other nations and having them join the Israelites. These people were also made in God's image, and therefore equally valuable, and wanted to be free of their Egyptian oppressors. The Torah is not interested in bloodlines nearly as much as it is in values. This is exemplified by the Jewish tradition that holds whoever becomes a Jew at any time is considered to have stood at Sinai. Verse 39. "And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough that they had taken out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, since they had been driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. Verse 40. The length of time that the Israelites lived in Egypt was 430 years. Verse 41. At the end of the 430th year, to the very day, all the ranks of the Lord departed from the land of Egypt. Verse 42. That was for the Lord a night of vigil to bring them out of the land of Egypt. That same night is the Lord's, one of vigil for all the children of Israel throughout the ages. Verse 43. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "This is the law of the Passover offering. No foreigner shall eat of it." Verse 44. But any slave a man has bought may eat of it once he has been circumcised. Verse 45. No bound or hired laborer shall eat of it. Verse 46. It shall be eaten in one house. You shall not take any of the flesh outside the house, nor shall you break a bone of it. Verse 47. The whole community of Israel shall offer it. Verse 48. If a stranger who dwells with you would offer the Passover to the Lord, all his males must be circumcised. Then he shall be admitted to offer it. He shall then be as a citizen of the country. But no uncircumcised person may eat of it. Any non-Israelite could join with the Jewish people and eat of the Passover sacrifice by becoming circumcised. Verse 49. There shall be one law for the citizen and for the stranger who dwells among you. This is one of the most important and morally sublime laws in the Torah, given to the Israelites as soon as they left Egypt, a society in which there wasn't one law for the citizen and for the stranger. As in many contemporary societies, in the ancient world there was no legal protection at all for the stranger. This Torah law, to the best of our knowledge, was unique in the ancient Near East, and one presumes, in the world. Verse 50. And all the Israelites did so. As the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. Verse 51. That very day, the Lord freed the Israelites from the land of Egypt, troop by troop. Chapter 13. Verse 1. The Lord spoke further to Moses, saying, Verse 2. Consecrate to me every firstborn, man and beast, the first issue of every womb from the Israelites is mine. Originally, before the Levites and a subgroup within the Levites, the priests, Kohanim, who carried out all the rituals involving animal sacrifice, were designated for temple service, firstborns of all tribes were consecrated to working for God. A son, who was his mother's first child, was supposed to be dedicated to God's service and to perform the religious rites subsequently assigned to the priests. In remembrance and recognition of this earlier tradition that firstborn children were consecrated to working for God, a later Torah law designates that 31 days after the child is born, the father can pay a priest 5 silver shekels, Numbers chapter 18, verse 16, to redeem the child from temple work. The ceremony of redeeming the firstborn is still practiced among observant Jews. It is known in Hebrew as Pidyon HaBen, redemption of the firstborn son. Today, a father gives the priest 5 silver dollars, indicating it was never intended to be a large sum of money, and therefore a burden for poor people. Verse 3. And Moses said to the people, "Remember this day on which you went free from Egypt, the house of bondage, how the Lord freed you from it with a mighty hand. No leavened bread shall be eaten." The Torah refers again and again to the importance of remembering the Exodus. As previously noted, see commentary to Exodus chapter 10, verse 2. Memory perpetuates gratitude. No memory, no gratitude. It perpetuates faith. No memory, no faith. And it perpetuates the Jewish people. No national memory, no nation. But there may be a fourth reason which is related to the second one, faith. The Exodus, a time when God intervened forcefully and unequivocally on behalf of the entire Jewish people, or on behalf of any national entity for that matter, may have been a unique moment in history. Clearly, there have been many times since the Exodus when Jews wished God had intervened on their behalf as he did in Egypt. But that was not to be. Therefore, for the sake of keeping alive trust in God, it has been critical to recall the Exodus, and for every Jew throughout the generations to identify with the Exodus as if he or she actually experienced it. As is written in the Passover Seder service, in every generation, a person is obligated to see himself as if he himself has come out of Egypt. Something powerful can happen when people assemble to express gratitude for something that happened. Not to them, or to their parents or grandparents or great-grandparents, but to ancestors who lived thousands of years earlier. By maintaining and expressing their gratitude, Jews have kept their faith and national identity alive. If people are only grateful when something good happens to them, they may never be grateful, or will be grateful only for the briefest of times. Alternatively, they will be grateful only if such good is done to them repeatedly, as epitomized by the question long associated with ingrates, "What have you done for me lately?" In sum, Jews are commanded to remember and celebrate the Exodus both as a statement of their faith and in order to maintain their faith. Verse 4. You go free on this day in the month of Abib. Abib is the Hebrew word for spring. In modern Hebrew, it is pronounced Aviv. The Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar, and therefore a year has 354 days, not 365, as does the solar calendar. The Hebrew lunar calendar is therefore adjusted by adding a leap month 7 years out of every 19, as opposed to a leap day every 4 years in the solar calendar. Otherwise, Passover would fall 11 days earlier each year. And within a few years, Passover would become a winter holiday, then a fall one, and then a summer one, and cease being a spring holiday as the Torah directs it to be. The Muslim calendar is also lunar, but since there is no specification as to the season in which a holiday must fall, the month of Ramadan, for example, falls in different seasons over the course of the years. Verse 5. So, when the Lord has brought you into the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, you shall observe in this month the following practice. Verse 6. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a festival of the Lord. Verse 7. Throughout the 7 days unleavened bread shall be eaten. No leavened bread shall be found with you, and no leaven shall be found in all your territory. Verse 8. And you shall explain to your son on that day, it is because of what the Lord did for me when I went free from Egypt. This is one of four verses in the Torah dealing with the commandment to educate children about the Exodus. The Talmud associated each of these verses with a different type of child. See comment on Exodus chapter 12, verse 26. In this verse, the Torah states only the parent's answer. As no question is cited, this child came to be known as the child who does not know how to ask. The parent's answer is given in the first person, because some children, and adults for that matter, are only able to relate to a self-centered explanation. Verse 9. And this shall serve you as a sign on your hand and as a reminder on your forehead, in order that the teaching of the Lord may be in your mouth, that with a mighty hand the Lord freed you from Egypt. This verse is one of the primary sources for the Jewish practice of wearing tefillin, two leather boxes, one on the forehead and one on the upper arm, that contain words from the Torah. See also Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 8. The word tefillin is usually translated as phylacteries, which is Greek for amulet or charm, neither of which properly describes tefillin. The word tefillin is etymologically related to the word tefillah, the Hebrew word for prayer. The Torah does not mention the word tefillin, nor does it specify that this sign must be an actual physical object, let alone what this object should be. Nevertheless, as archaeological evidence has documented, tefillin have been physical objects for thousands of years. Regarding the words on your forehead, the Hebrew literally states between your eyes, yet another indication they were intended to be tangible objects. In practice, the head tefillin are placed in the center of the forehead, above and between the two eyes. Verse 10. You shall keep this institution at its set time from year to year. Verse 11. And when the Lord has brought you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and to your fathers, and has given it to you, verse 12, you shall set apart for the Lord every first issue of the womb. Every male firstling that your cattle drop shall be the Lord's. Verse 13, but every firstling ass you shall redeem with a sheep. According to the medieval commentator Ibn Ezra, since this, the donkey, was the only Israelite animal unfit for sacrifice, it was a non-kosher animal, therefore bringing a donkey for a sacrifice would have been like bringing a pig for sacrifice. No other species had to be redeemed in this way. Therefore, given that the priest had no use for an animal unfit for sacrifice, the owner of the donkey had to give the priest a sheep instead. Verse 13 continued, if you do not redeem it, you must break its neck. Only if the owner gives the priest a sheep in place of the donkey is he permitted to keep the donkey. But if the owner does not bring a sheep, the donkey had to be killed so as not to be used. This law guaranteed Israelites paid their dues to the priests. Verse 13 continued, and you must redeem every firstborn male among your children. See the commentary to verse 2. Verse 14, and when in time to come your son asks you, saying, what does this mean? This question is associated with the simple child, because it is brief, straightforward, and unsophisticated. See comment on Exodus chapter 12, verse 26. The answer given to the simple child is different from the answer given to the child who does not know how to ask, because no two children are the same. Families almost always include different types of children, and parents must come up with the most appropriate answers for each of them. This notion is best expressed in Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6. Educate a child, each according to his way. In general, children should not be raised in precisely the same way as their siblings. That is, have the same achievements expected of them, automatically be sent to the same school, disciplined in the same way, etc. Verse 14 continued, you shall say to him, it was with a mighty hand that the Lord brought us out from Egypt, the house of bondage. The purpose of this answer is to impress the simple child with God's strength, since this child is unlikely to be able to appreciate the nuances of the Exodus story. Verse 15. When Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord slew every firstborn in the land of Egypt, the firstborn of both man and beast. Therefore I sacrifice to the Lord every first male issue of the womb, but redeem every firstborn among my sons. Verse 16. And so it shall be as a sign upon your hand, and as a symbol on your forehead, that with a mighty hand the Lord freed us from Egypt. Verse 17. Now when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although it was nearer. For God said, the people may have a change of heart when they see war and return to Egypt. God knows that as ex-slaves who were in bondage for generations, the Israelites were not prepared to wage war against the Philistines, or presumably anyone else. Verse 18. So God led the people round about, by way of the wilderness at the Sea of Reeds. Now the Israelites went up armed out of the land of Egypt. This is the sea God will split, so the Israelites can pass through safely. Verse 19. And Moses took with him the bones of Joseph, who had exacted an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will be sure to take notice of you. Then you shall carry up my bones from here with you. As we read in Genesis chapter 50, verse 25, so Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, when God has taken notice of you, you shall carry up my bones from here. It is Moses, presumably the busiest of the departing Israelites, who remembers this promise. We have debts to the dead as well as the living. Verse 20. They set out from Succoth and encamped at Etham, at the edge of the wilderness. Verse 21. The Lord went before them in a pillar of cloud by day to guide them along the way, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light that they might travel day and night. Verse 22. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. Chapter 14, Verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, verse 2, tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, before Baal-Zephon. The next verse explains that God wants the Israelites to change their course, so Pharaoh will think they have lost their way. Verse 2 continued, you shall encamp facing it by the sea. The sea refers to the sea God will split and the Israelites will cross. Verse 3, Pharaoh will say of the Israelites, they are astray in the land. The wilderness has closed in on them. Verse 4, then I will stiffen Pharaoh's heart and he will pursue them. God is glorified when he is perceived as just. Verse 4 continued, that I may gain glory through Pharaoh and all his host. When God inflicts or exacts just revenge, which is really just another term for punishment, on evildoers such as Pharaoh, his name is glorified. In other words, God gains glory by rewarding good and punishing evil. This can be shown by answering this question. What is it that causes many thinking and decent people not to believe in God, let alone glorify him? The answer is the amount of injustice in the world. That being the case, when God deals with injustice, he is most likely to be universally affirmed and glorified. Justice is indeed God's glory. Thus, the centrality of abolishing evil, punishing those who commit it, and of course, doing good in the Torah. Ironically, however, this is also a major reason many people reject the Torah and God. Many people are uncomfortable with being morally judged, and especially uncomfortable with a God who judges them, that is, a God who might punish them. That is why, for example, surveys indicate far more people reject the concept of hell, afterlife punishment, than the concept of heaven, afterlife reward. God hates evil and instructs us to do likewise. You who love God must hate evil. Psalms 97 verse 2. Then we humans too can be glorified. Verse 4 continued, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And they did so. In spite of the 10 plagues and all the other miracles, the Egyptians still do not recognize God as the God of the world. Hence, they continue to monitor the Israelites' movements, thinking they can outwit the Israelites' God. Sarna argues that the words, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, means the Egyptians will finally realize the world is governed by a moral order that must ultimately prevail. Verse 5. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his courtiers had a change of heart about the people and said, what is this we have done, releasing Israel from our service? Verse 6. He ordered his chariot and took his men with him. The Hebrew literally states Pharaoh hitched, not ordered his chariot. The traditional commentators noted Pharaoh was so anxious to pursue the Israelites that he prepared his chariot, rather than taking the time to order a servant to do it for him. Archaeological evidence documents chariots were invented shortly before Pharaoh's time. Thus, they would have been seen as among the most, if not the most, advanced military weapons of the time. Verse 7. He took 600 of his picked chariots and the rest of the chariots of Egypt with officers in all of them. Verse 8. The Lord stiffened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he gave chase to the Israelites. As the Israelites were departing defiantly, verse 9, the Egyptians gave chase to them, and all the chariot horses of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his warriors, overtook them encamped by the sea, near Pi-Hahiroth, before Baal-Zephon. Verse 10. As Pharaoh drew near, the Israelites caught sight of the Egyptians advancing upon them. Greatly frightened, the Israelites cried out to the Lord. Only two verses earlier, the Israelites were described as leaving Egypt defiantly. But the moment they see the Egyptians pursuing them, they cower. Understandably, given their centuries of servitude, the Israelites still have a slave mentality, not the mentality necessary to wage war, despite the fact they are armed. Exodus chapter 13, verse 18. That is why God, Ibn Ezra writes, subsequently arranged for that whole generation of males to die in the wilderness, for they would not have had the gumption to fight the Canaanites, to be replaced by a generation that had not known exile and slavery. The Israelites welcomed their liberation from Egypt with joy, but soon found themselves filled with fear and depression when they considered the burdens and responsibilities of their newfound freedom, including self-defense and self-reliance. The Israelites will later entertain the possibility of returning to Egypt. Verse 11. And they said to Moses, "Was it for want of graves in Egypt that you brought us to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us, taking us out of Egypt?" The Israelites' complaint is sarcastic. If any nation had enough graves, it was Egypt, whose religion revolved around death. Is it worth dying to be free? Verse 12. Is this not the very thing we told you in Egypt, saying, "Let us be, and we will serve the Egyptians"? For it is better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. The Israelites claim they would rather return to slavery than confront the Egyptians in battle. This, to be fair, is understandable. Most people would rather be enslaved than dead. Most, but not all. One of the most famous statements of the American War of Independence was that of the American patriot Patrick Henry, "Give me liberty or give me death." Henry's attitude, the antithesis of what the Israelites are saying here, helped make the founding of America possible, as well as the liberation of Europe and the independence of South Korea and many other free countries. But it is hardly a universal sentiment. During the Cold War between the Democratic West and the Soviet Union, there were, of course, many in the West who said, "better dead than red," communist. But many others subscribed to the slogan associated with Bertrand Russell, the 20th century's leading atheist philosopher, "better red than dead." Russell's slogan was consistent with that of much of the well-educated class in Britain. On February 8, 1933, right after Hitler came to power in Germany, the Oxford Union Debating Society held a debate on the resolution, "This House will in no circumstances fight for its king and country." The resolution passed 275-153. The vote made an impression on Hitler and Mussolini, as it revealed that many of England's best educated would prefer to live under Nazism or fascism than to fight for freedom and risk death. The Israelites' statement made it clear to Moses they so valued life they would be willing to return to everything they endured in captivity, even the Egyptians seeking to murder all of their newborn males in order to avoid doing battle with the Egyptians. Verse 13. But Moses said to the people, "Have no fear. Stand by and witness the deliverance which the Lord will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you will never see again." Verse 14. The Lord will battle for you. You hold your peace. This is perhaps the one time in Jewish history in which the Jews did not have to stand up for themselves and could simply rely on God. This is one of many ways the Exodus was a unique event. Verse 15. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry out to me? Tell the Israelites to go forward." Nevertheless, even in this singular instance, God does not want the Israelites to be utterly passive. Crying out to God is fine, but it never precludes taking action to the extent we're able. Words attributed to St. Augustine, but probably not actually said by him, are a good guideline. Pray as if everything depends on God. Work as if everything depends on you. Verse 16. And you lift up your rod and hold out your arm over the sea and split it, so that the Israelites may march into the sea on dry ground. Verse 17. And I will stiffen the hearts of the Egyptians so that they go in after them. And I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his warriors, his chariots and his horsemen. Verse 18. Let the Egyptians know that I am Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen. Verse 19. The angel of God. In the Torah, angels of God are messengers who may take any form, human or otherwise. Verse 19. Continued, who had been going ahead of the Israelite army, now moved and followed behind them, and the pillar of cloud shifted from in front of them and took up a place behind them. Verse 20, and it came between the army of the Egyptians and the army of Israel. The cloud rests here to temporarily halt the advance of the Egyptian army. Verse 20 continued, "Thus there was the cloud with the darkness, and it cast a spell upon the night." The NIV provides a more helpful translation. Throughout the night, the cloud brought darkness to the one side and light to the other side, so neither went near the other all night long. Verse 20 continued, "so that the one could not come near the other all through the night." Why did God use winds to split the sea? Verse 21. Then Moses held out his arm over the sea, and the Lord drove back the sea with a strong east wind all that night and turned the sea into dry ground. The waters were split. God could have split the sea at any time or in any way. He did not need winds to do it when, for example, Moses would lift his arm. But instead, God sends strong winds to part the waters. Like most of the miracles, the splitting of the sea was achieved through God's manipulation of nature. There are two likely reasons for this. The first, and probably the most likely, was to reinforce in the minds of the Israelites that God controls nature. Nature is not a god. The other possible reason for his use of nature to achieve this miracle and nearly all the other miracles of the Exodus was to enable the skeptic to deny the splitting of the sea was in fact a divine miracle. It wasn't God. Fortuitous winds did it. This seems to be God's approach in general. Much like God wanted Pharaoh to have the strength to exercise his own will with regard to letting the Israelites go, rather than be coerced into it by God, he apparently wants human beings to be free to choose to believe in him, rather than to compel them to believe in him by making his existence incontrovertible. Just as the skeptic at the sea could claim winds coming at just the right moment split the sea, so too we are all free to argue that all of life, indeed all of the universe, came about by coincidence. God could have easily made us as certain of his existence as we are of anything material, but he didn't. He wants humans to have free will, and that must include the freedom to choose or reject God. Verse 22, "And the Israelites went into the sea on dry ground, the waters forming a wall for them on their right and on their left." Verse 23, "The Egyptians came in pursuit after them into the sea, all of Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and horsemen." The Egyptians followed the Israelites into the sea in accordance with God's prediction to Moses in verse 17. Verse 24, "At the morning watch," each night had three watches, the morning watch lasted from about 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. Verse 24 continued, "The Lord looked down upon the Egyptian army from a pillar of fire and cloud and threw the Egyptian army into panic." Verse 25, "He locked the wheels of their chariots so that they moved forward with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, 'Let us flee from the Israelites, for the Lord is fighting for them against Egypt.'" In accord with the famous statement, "Hell is truth seen too late," the Egyptians finally recognized the Lord, YHVH, as God. But it was too late. They drowned with that knowledge. Verse 26, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Hold out your arm over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, and upon their chariots, and upon their horsemen.'" Verse 27, "Moses held out his arm over the sea, and at daybreak the sea returned to its normal state, and the Egyptians fled at its approach, but the Lord hurled the Egyptians into the sea." God had the Egyptians drowned at a time of day when the Israelites would be able to see it happen. The Israelites, who so feared the Egyptians, needed to see their oppressors destroyed. Verse 28, "The waters turned back and covered the chariots and the horsemen. Pharaoh's entire army that followed them into the sea, not one of them remained." The miraculous drowning of the Egyptians is narrated without literary flourish. Indeed, the Torah offers a rather mundane description of what was surely one of the most remarkable events in history. Verse 29, "But the Israelites had marched through the sea on dry ground, the waters forming a wall for them on their right and on their left." Verse 30, "Thus the Lord delivered Israel that day from the Egyptians. Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the shore of the sea. Presumably, the waves washed the Egyptian corpses onto the shore, Bechor shore. The difference between belief in God and trusting God.